You know the feeling when your mate's golf ball flies past yours? Or when you're on the green in regulation, but he holds it from the bunker? At Drummond Golf, we get it. That's why we have our lowest price guarantee. As Australia's biggest, you can count on our massive buying power for the lowest prices in golf. But if you do happen to find a lower advertised price, we'll beat it. The Drummond Golf lowest price guarantee. Unbeatable. Conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to episode 113 of The Thing About Golf, Golf Australia Magazine's ongoing quest to uncover the answer to the question, why do people get so obsessed with this game? My name's Rod Murray, and if, like me, you grew up watching golf in Australia in the 1990s, then today's guest will be a very familiar name. If, on the other hand, you've only been watching golf the last 10 years or so, today's guest will still be a familiar name as he is an integral part of the Sky Sports commentary team. Wayne Radar Riley strides the fairways analysing and critiquing the game's best players these days. But there was a time when he himself was on the big stage hitting the big shots. His unforgettable long putt at the 72nd hole of the 1991 Australian Open is one of the tournament's most iconic moments. And while there are players with better records than his two European Tour wins, there are a few with the personality that's made him a fan favourite among commentators. From humble beginnings in Sydney to rubbing shoulders with the very best in the game, Riley's is a life that has been completely immersed in golf. And after this chat with John Huggan, you'll feel like you know the man behind the mic just a little bit better.
Okay, welcome to the latest edition of the Thing About Golf podcast. My guest this time round is one of the more familiar faces, names, voices in Australian golf over the last 30-odd years. I always start with the same question, as everybody knows. Wayne Riley, what was and is the thing about golf for you?
The thing about golf for me, hello everybody, thanks for having me, John. It's man against the elements, the whole family thing.
What do you mean by that?
Well, golf, I feel, is like no other sport. Like, we are one big family. We are golfers. Especially when you get on tour, that's what you are, and you want to stay within that family because it's so easy to lose your card, which happened to me and happens to everybody eventually, unless, of course, you're Tiger Woods and Rory McIlroy. They're going to stay till they're 100.
Yeah.
Hopefully the sponsors will want them.
Yeah.
But I like the whole thing about golf, the whole vibe about the game. When I was a kid, I used to watch on television. Especially the first I really watched was 79. That's when I watched close up and personal Seve car park job at Royal Lytham. And just the whole thing about golf, it's just the whole ambiance of the game. And the other thing is I don't have to share the ball. It's my ball. You can go away. You're not coming anywhere near my ball. It's mine and I'm hitting it. Yeah. I don't have to pass it to anybody.
Yeah, yeah. Did you dabble in other team sports as a kid?
Yeah, football. I played soccer, yeah.
Yeah.
And I was quite good at it, but all my friends actually left to go to golf. So when I was 14, I was getting kind of representative level at soccer. We call it soccer in Australia, football.
What position?
Up front. I was not tall, so I was number 9 and didn't have to be tall. I wasn't a great header because I couldn't reach it most of the time. But, yeah, I had a talent for it being my ball and kicking it in. So going to golf was a natural progression, really.
Is it kind of ball sense you've got? I mean, most people, I think, who play any ball sport at a decent level can kind of dabble in the others.
Yeah. Yeah, I could kick with both feet as good as the other. Mm-hmm. Actually, I'm right-footed, but my left-footer, I kick it stronger. Can't play golf left-handed at all. Can't play tennis or ping-pong left-handed. But I can catch, I can kick. And that sort of thing. So,
So when did it become apparent that you had a talent, shall we say, for the golf?
And not until I was like 17. It took me 3 or 4 years to, even though I started playing golf at 7, living on a golf course in Sydney, right next door to a golf course called Hurstville Golf Course, a little muni, great little muni, Royal Hurstville. And when I first started, it was 9 holes. Then they extended the course, John, to 15 holes. Quite a
interesting.
quite a funny old number, 15 holes. And now we're 18, obviously. But, living next door to a golf course, I was playing when I was 7, along with playing football as well. But I used to go down and look for golf balls. That's how I made my pocket money. I was self-sufficient, really. My parents didn't have to give me any money because I'd go down and find golf balls and sell them back to the members or the public and make a few quid. Most of the time they'd hit it in the trees and I'd stand on it. Have you seen that ball, son? No, sir. I don't know where it is. Yeah. And it'd be under my foot. But there it is. You know, it was a great way to sort of buy myself a set of golf club, even though my parents did that sort of thing. But it was a great way to have pocket money.
So when did it become clear to you that this is what you wanted to do with your life?
Oh, a year into that, because I was an apprentice at 15 years of age. I went and worked at a golf club, a Cronulla Golf Club, where I'm still a member. And I worked under a great boss called Ian Brander. And he taught me, and I had to be at work every morning at 6 in the morning. Even though I didn't start at 8, that's what time I had to get to work to practice. Even if it was raining in the heat of the summer. If it was raining, put the wet weather gear out, son. You're going out to hit some balls to get used to all that sort of thing, that whatever was going to be required to play professional sports. So I was very lucky to have an incredible boss who had the foresight to make me do the right things. And I knew then that's what I wanted to do, and the burning desire I felt was going to get me over the line. Not to be a great player. I was never a great player. I think the word great is used these days way too loosely.
It depends on your definition, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I was a good player.
Yeah.
You know, I was a journeyman winner. I won 6 times.
No, you were better than average, that's for sure.
Yeah, better than an average pro, absolutely. Yeah. But, you know, great player. You know, when people even in commentary say, oh, he's a great player. No, come on, stop it. Seve's a great player.
Yeah.
Tiger's a great player. Rory's a great player. All these obvious names are great players. We are the ones to make them look good. They have to beat up on someone, and I was one of them.
It always makes me worry. I worry a bit for the World Golf Hall of Fame, you know, when they're starting to get people in there that, you know, they've got everybody in pretty much that should be in. So where do you go from here? You know, you've got to wait 10 years for the next lot to emerge, but they want to have a ceremony every year.
Yeah. I know, and they seem to tease them. I was, you know, I did a tournament with here in Dubai and Rory, and I was thinking to myself, he's already got a Hall of Fame career, which we don't really look at over here in UK or Australia. But I like the Hall of Fame idea. I think it's a good idea. And he's already won. I think he's won 23 times on the PGA Tour. That is qualification. I think if you won 2 majors, qualification.
Yeah, he's won 4. Almost getting it.
So he's in. Yeah. When do they put them in? Do they tease them?
Well, they should wait until they're 50, because Ernie, I think, and Phil have been in for way too early. You know, you should wait until you're at least 50, I think.
Yeah.
Anyway, and plus the World Golf Hall of Fame, now that we're on that subject briefly, I've written this. I think that there's only one place in the world where you should have the World Golf Hall of Fame. It should be at St. Andrews. They'd get thousands of people coming to see it.
Well, you've got the museum, which is magnificent if you've ever been through it.
It's not big enough.
Well, it's not big enough, but it's there. And I've done a piece through that, and I loved it. I absolutely adored it.
I'd like to see 3 times the size.
And it should be.
Yeah.
And you're right. That's where it shouldn't be, in Florida.
No. Nobody goes there.
No, it really is. That is an extremely good point. This is where the World Hall of Famers should be, at St. Andrews.
Well, St. Andrews is moving with, you know, there's thousands of Americans there every week of the year except Christmas.
Well, it's golf, isn't it? It's St. Andrews, so, mate. It's not far from where you live. I mean, it's just St. Andrews, if you haven't been there, you must go. Really, you must go. It's an incredible place.
Anyway, I've dragged you off the subject there.
Yeah.
Tell me, when did you start to stand out then? When, obviously, competitively, you were... You say we've touched on how good your career was, but when did you start to think, well, I can actually beat people at this? I'm better than that.
When I was an apprentice, and every Monday we used to have trainee matches, and we used to play on a Monday, and about 80 junior professionals would put the money in. And the last year I won 7 out of 11 of them. I played 11 because we had 2 apprentices, me and another guy called Daryl Purchase, fine player in himself, and we had to alternate to between who could play. And the last year, out of 11, I won 7. And they gave me a national invite, which meant I could go and play with the big boys and play professional golf when I was about 17 or 18. So that's when I knew I could seriously go low. But consistency always was an issue. I mean, it's still right through my career.
Why was that?
Is
that a temperament thing?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know,
there's
a cocktail of things, John, going on in this mind of mine that sort of it doesn't my personality, during playing professional golf, I had to play against my personality, believe it. A lot of people are told to play with your personality, but mine, hyper, jumping up and down, you know, whatever I've got, I don't know. I don't want to go and get checked because I might have them all. But it's like, you know, I had to really slow down. I had to walk at 3/4 pace consciously.
Yeah.
You know, my caddy was always told, tell him to walk slow, Radar, walk slow. Just smell the coffee and breathe through your nose and all this sort of stuff. But, you know to do it, to be able to be told to do it and it worked when I could do it, it was very hard. It was very hard to do such a thing. But there's so many golfers that you can see that are jumping around, and I'm sure that they are told the same thing.
Did it cost you down the stretch, especially when you – obviously when the pressure's at its highest?
Not really, no. I didn't ever really choke anything. Once I had the lead, I was able to get over the line. The only thing that I always think about, I never backed into a tournament, which a lot of players had this uncanny ability to post a score with 5 holes to play and they're in the clubhouse 2 behind and still win. That never happened to me. I always had to win. The 6 I won, I had to win them. Yeah. I never got given anything, which peed me off a little bit.
Yeah, well, you know, it's Nick Faldo had about 6 or 7 majors, whatever it was, and I think 3 or 4 of them, he did what you just described. He just hung around and other guys fell away.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Maybe that had something to do with I just thought you had to go out and win it. Patience wasn't my thing.
We're jumping ahead a little bit here with this question, but it comes to mind. When you do the job that you do now, you're out there, you're walking with really the last groups. So you see the guys in contention to win Sunday afternoon. Can you tell what's going to happen to an extent if somebody is going to win or not going to win? Have you heard?
Yeah, well, I can. That's a very, very good question. That's a great question in the respect of only a few players I can tell. Only a few players. We are sitting here at the Dubai Desert Classic, and I was here back in the day. Oh, is it 2008 Tiger won?
Something like that.
Yeah. Well, he's 4 back going into the back 9. And I'm walking from here to the 9th green to the 10th tee, which is a long walk. And I thought to myself, this is going to be interesting. Last group, here's Tiger, red shirt on, all that, 4 back. How's he going to get this done? Well, he won without a playoff. Mm. Now, I couldn't see that coming. But if you get me out on a golf course and I have a player who's a lesser like with a Rory McIlroy who is 2 shots behind and Rory McIlroy's 2 back and he's going at this, I can – I make a habit of looking into their eyes and see, all right, mate, you're cacking it a bit here. You know, you're feeling it and Rory isn't.
Yeah.
Because Rory hasn't got anything to lose. Rory wins another tournament.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's how it is. But if Rory bottles it and loses it and, you know, we start talking about that, like last week with Tommy Fleetwood, did Rory lose it? I'm not so sure. A lot of people think he did. Because what he did on the last holes, try to play a big hook because that was his go-to shot because he wasn't driving it any good. And I was very happy for him. He tried to play the shot, just didn't happen. Just hit it in the water and that's the way it is. That's what Rory gets, the old Forrest Gump, box of chocolates. You don't know what you're going to get with Rory McIlroy.
Yeah.
But when you get dynamic, you get them. But there's only a few players, John, that you look at and go, you know what? Yeah, I can tell you're under the cosh here, and the other guy isn't. And
what are the signs though? Without looking in the
very rocks. Very interesting. I've done so many tournaments. I've probably played less tournaments now than I've broadcasted on. I don't have added them up. Yeah. But you look at the great players. Spieth at his best. I mean, Spieth at his best at Birkdale there when he absolutely demoralised. What's his name?
Kuchar.
Kuchar did everything he could to win that. And then Spieth hits it on the practice fairway, holds it from 6 feet or 12 feet for a bogey, and then stiffs it, birdies, 80-foot eagle putt, 40-foot birdie putt, 20-foot birdie putt, just keep going. And you get that with a Spieth. You get that with these kids that are, even girls these days, you look at Lydia Ko in her prime, what they do. I mean, they do. And I love watching ladies golf. I seriously do. And you're like, you know, some of them have it. The giveaway is some of them have it and you just get that feeling. You go, this guy is better than this guy. I'm cheering for the guy who's the lesser like. I want him to beat him, really.
Yeah.
Because I don't care who wins. I really couldn't care less. If an Australian's out there and Rory, if Adam Scott's playing against Rory McIlroy, I know them both as well as each other. I seriously don't go for nations or anything like that. If you can win a 72-hole championship event head-to-head against great players, I'm all for you. So you can just tell the better players have this air about them. And let me tell you, a 50 in the world guy knows it when he's playing head to head with a guy who's top five.
Right.
But how do I tell? I don't know. I can smell it. You know, it's just the way it is. And a lot of things in their eyes, you know?
Yeah. Well, anyway, I just thought I'd ask that. It was as it came
up. Well, you know what it's like being a broadcaster and a journo? You can tell how someone is when you walk off the 18th green and you're talking to them and you're writing down in your pad. There's a lot to be said in the eyes, isn't
there? Yeah. Anyway, let's go back to you're going to think about playing golf for a living. You're of the era, I assume, of the Aussies went to Europe. They didn't all go to America necessarily. Europe was the kind of traditional route. Is that basically what you just followed, the lead of everybody else?
Yeah, I did. I actually always wanted to play in America, and I did. I had my card in America. After I won the Aussie Open, I got a lot of invites in America and played well enough to be able to keep my card. And they said to me, would you like to have a couple more because you only need two more tournaments and a little bit more money? And I said, no, I want to play in Europe. I just loved it in Europe. But why, I don't know. It's a big regret, though. I mean, I should have probably done that and taken my card and played in America. But America's a lot different in the respect of it's a lot lonelier over there. You're always in different hotels by yourself. And you're by yourself in these hotels and you don't really see too many people. And you're always with your caddy. And who wants to live with their caddy 24/7?
Well, yeah.
You don't want to do that. And so I liked Europe. We're all in the same hotels. And because there were so many of us, we got to stay in. They did great deals. We could stay in wonderful hotels. I love the idea of going from the Dutch to the Irish to the Spanish to wonderful European places.
Culturally, there's no
place. There's no place. It's just the most incredible tour.
It's a common theme that I've heard that from a lot of players where they're stuck in a Courtyard Marriott in the middle of nowhere, and it's the same as the Courtyard Marriott you'll be in next week. And
vending machine with an air conditioner in your room that makes more noise than a semi-trailer going down the road. Exactly. I mean, you know exactly what I'm talking about, and it's true. But I would have liked to have done it. And these days, these boys can't afford their luxury just to stay in Europe because they're playing for so much more money.
Does your regret come from being the thought that you were good enough, do you think?
I think I was good enough, yeah. I think I was good enough to play very well on there. Well, I did. I only played 12 tournaments over there in the respect of in and out, and I never missed a cut in America. And the first tournament I played in, I ran fifth or something like that, and I thought, because it's one-dimensional American golf.
Yes.
That's what it is. You miss the green. It doesn't run over the back of the green like it does at Berwick.
Yeah.
You know, down the bottom of the hill, and you've got to bump it back into the hill, scoot it up there and manufacture something. Yeah. It's just we're going to play a grass explosion shot, and then you go into a bunker. It's a very similar shot. So you're playing something that's basically always the same. It's like
that's always been one of my criticisms.
No matter where you go, you get one.
The top players in America on that tour, they become very, very good at a very narrow form of golf. And there's no real range to it or diversity or whatever you want to call it. And I think the game at the top level has lost a bit of that because the equipment is part of that is too. You know, you can't shape shots like you used to either.
No, I totally agree with you. It's going to be interesting what's going to happen with the ball, whether that's going to slow down, whether it's going to be softer, how they do it, I don't know. Whether you can maneuver it more like you and I could when we were lads.
Steady.
Yeah,
I'm not sure I did.
I know you were quite good from what I heard.
Yeah. Anyway, so you went to Europe. I mean, and where did it go from there?
Well, I came to Europe and I played over here and loved it. Yeah, bought a little pad over here and ended up getting married over here. We don't want to go there, John. But then I've got four wonderful children. Two daughters, two lads, and which are all going very, very well, very proud, very happy, very lucky. And they all live in the UK. And that's where I'm based in Sydney and in England, even though that's going to be more in England, really. I'm going to change that a little because Australia, when you get to my age, is a little too far away. I can't do it. It's the best thing
and the worst thing about Australia.
It certainly is. We're our own worst enemy in the respect of, you know, I don't mind going back once or twice a year, but, you know, back in the day when I used to go five times home, I can't do it anymore. And it's really hard. I miss it. Anything Australian on television, I'm into it, sports-wise. I mean, I'm not watching Neighbours or Home and Away, so don't, you know. But it's anything Australian, movies, which we're getting very good at. And you know, I miss my country so very much, especially Sydney. It'll always be my home, and I love it. And being over in Europe, I love it as well, because I've got two homes. I've been very lucky that over in the UK, they've adopted me very, very well as an Australian. They either like you or they don't, the Brits, whether you're Australian, and I've been very fortunate indeed. They like the wicked sense of humour, yeah. I think.
Can you lump the Brits into one group? I mean, you know, I'm Scottish and we wouldn't like to be, you know, categorised as being the same as the English.
I go up to Scotland a lot, as you know. You're just a little more quieter with a more wicked sense of humour.
You think?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think you are. And I think the Irish and the Welsh fall into one.
Yeah, we're all Celts together.
They are so unbelievably good sense of humour. And the English are English, aren't they?
Sadly, yes. Well, that's another subject. I wanted to get into your wins. Yeah. Before you came along with the hat and the voice and all the rest of it on telly, I think most people would have known you for, certainly down under, would be for the Aussie Open win, which was an extraordinary thing I want you to talk through. And where I come from, the Scottish Open win, which I'll get into in a minute. But start with the Aussie Open, which I think is, as things go, I mean, it's probably one of the more famous ones, you know, just the way you did it in the end.
The Aussie Open was something that I always wanted to win. If you always want to win your own national open. The year before was 1990, was at the Australian Golf Club, and I blew it. I was like one back with three holes to go. And I went bogey, bogey. Then I finished birdie, and John Morse won that. And I thought, you know, I'm not that good to be in contention of the Aussie Open every single year. Have I blown my chance? Well, the next year it was at Royal Melbourne, so I was very positive about playing well and went in there. And all week I played fantastic. I really did. I was working with a guy, Dennis Pugh. I'm sure you've all heard of Dennis.
Yes, he's been on this podcast.
He's doing incredible things.
As has your caddy that week, by the way.
Yeah, Lindsay. Yep. Lindsay was just incredible. And she actually said to me, going down 15, she said, if you don't get your head out of your ass and concentrate and stop whinging about not holing putts, you're never going to remember winning this Australian Open. And I was two back. And I thought, what are you talking about? How am I going to win this? I haven't held a putt all week. I've played like Jack Nicklaus and can't hold a thing, putting like Edward Scissorhands. Well, hit it into 15 feet on 15. I miss it. Oh, well, here we go now. But then 16, hit it to 9 feet, hole it. 17, I hit it to 20 feet, hole it for a birdie. And the last hole, I hit it to 33 feet. And I was shaking like a leaf. And I hit this putt up the 18th green at Royal Melbourne in, and the rest was history.
What was that feeling like? Can you remember?
Incredible feeling. I'll never forget it. And it's 30-odd years ago now, 32 years, how many years ago? And it feels like yesterday. I still remember the little kid behind because the grandstands were full because it was a – look, I'm going to go back. It was when the Australian Open was the Australian Open.
Yeah.
Am I allowed to say that, John?
Well, yes, I know exactly what you mean. It's not what it was, let's put it that way.
It's not, and hopefully we will get it back. It will happen. Whether it goes down the route it's going down now, I don't know. But it will happen because, you know, I think we had three or four major champions playing when I won it. And other years we had all the major champions, you know, there. Yeah. It was when we could afford it, I suppose. Money's a big thing. Tax is a big thing. So the feeling was, yes, incredible, especially to go back to Sydney the next day. And I remember I was living in this apartment in Sydney and had my own place. And just to walk up and have breakfast the next day with truck drivers driving past and yelling, how's it going, champ? And that was, I still remember it. And how does that, you know, it was an incredible, it's a proud thing that I've done, you know. And it, even though it's so long ago now, if I go to a golf club and you're introduced, I'm always introduced as an Australian Open champion.
Yeah. I'm right in thinking you did that with a broom handle.
Yes, I did.
When did that become?
4 weeks before it.
And was it a necessity or?
Necessity.
Yeah.
I went home.
Run me through the symptoms.
Well, the symptoms. Live rattlesnake comes to mind.
Yeah.
And I played well all year in Europe. And I went home very early. I went home early September, actually straight after Cran up on the mountain. Had my card, played well enough. I said, I'm going to go home. I'm going to do something different. I'm going to get a long putter. And I'm going to practice every single day. And I didn't hit a ball for 5 weeks. All I did was putt with this long putter. So I went and played the Air New Zealand Open, which the year before I'd won, and with the short putter. But so I went there and I played all right. I ran about 20th. That was two weeks before, something like that. So then I went into the Royal Melbourne, the Australian Open, with this new long putter. And I was putting great, but just wasn't holing anything until those last three holes. But the long putter changed my life. I mean, because I wasn't very good. My alignment was all wrong.
How bad was it, though? I mean, I want to get into how bad it was.
Yeah. No, it wasn't horrific.
I like people talking about the yips.
No, it's not yips. No, I wasn't yips. I just felt very – well, I did when I was a youngster. I felt pretty good with a short putter, always a bullseye putter. And was all right with it, but very – and then I changed the posture and couldn't find my way back to where I was good with the short putter. My shoulders as a right hand was always open. My right shoulder was kinked out too much. I was aiming left. Not a Billy Mayfair, for those of you who remember Billy Mayfair's Mr. Squiggle kind of action.
Right.
Not like that, but my alignment was all out, so the consistency wasn't there, and I just couldn't find it. So I needed to become a child once more. You know, like your golf club, anyone's golf club, you see the 12-year-old kids putting out the front when you're in the clubhouse having a few cold ones. These kids are out there, look at them, and they're all unbelievably good. You wouldn't take these 12 or 13-year-old kids on. Yeah. And that's what I wanted to feel once more, and that was something that was new to me that I could build on. That's what happened.
Yeah, I always laugh at the guys that played at your level. They spend a lot of time trying to get back to play like they did as kids.
Yeah.
Well, that's because they start getting in your own way, right?
That's what it's all about, just to play like you were as a kid, you know, putting out there on the putting green and pretending you're holing them for the whatever championships, and that's what I did, and that's what happened.
Did you feel different about yourself after you won that event?
No, not really. No. I didn't feel different about myself. I wasn't going to be like I was going to be some kind of superstar. I was always a better hitter than I was a putter. And me getting a long putter wasn't going to all of a sudden make me Ben Crenshaw. You know, you have to be honest with yourself. And you know, I was very consistent and very good. But... you know, I was never going to be – I was 29 to 30 years old. You kind of know that, you're going to go all right. You're going to win a few championships and it's all going to be good, you know. But, I was never, ever going to be a world beater because my putting just simply wasn't good enough.
I want to get into the Scottish Open win. I'm interested in your definition of that. Was it a bigger win than the Aussie Open but less important to you as a person?
Less important.
Yeah.
Bigger win. But both people ask that question. That I'm very lucky to have won on two iconic golf courses. I think where I won the Australian Open and where I won the Scottish in being Royal Melbourne and Carnoustie, where I won them is bigger than the titles themselves. Sometimes. I you win around Carnoustie.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm the mother of all mothers.
I'm a big fan of that course, but it's a bleak place. But my goodness, it's a good place.
And beating Faldo head to head.
Yeah,
Monty on Saturday, Faldo on Sunday.
Yeah, right. I want to get into that. I made some notes on this just because I knew you. Scottish Open win, very impressive. Faldo was second, Monty was third, Duval was fifth, and Lyle and Westwood were in the top 20 as well, and. See if you can name the guy who was tied for 47th, 17 shots.
Tiger Woods.
Tiger Woods, well done.
Had breakfast with him. Yeah. my wife and I sat there, and young kid, I knew he was a US amateur champion.
Yeah, he was still an amateur at the time.
The truth shouldn't get in the way of a good story. But, yeah, it wasn't long after that Sandy said, you know, Sandy the great What was it? I'd never played there.
Yeah, that's right. Have you? What do you think of Tiger Woods? Never played there.
But yeah, he was. But I remember the caddies on tour that week in the practice rounds saying, "We've all seen the chosen one," including my caddy that time, Gordon Faulkner. They said that they just saw this, and I said, "Oh, I've heard it all before." And next minute, only 2 years later, we're watching him at the Masters win by 12 or 13 shots. Yeah. Just surreal it was, like how fast he blossomed, he bloomed.
Yeah, but still, you can see you beat him by 17.
But he didn't know anything about links when he first started. No, like Watson,
he admitted that.
He totally admitted it, and Watson was the same. Watson said, "How am I going to do this?" But it takes a while, and I grew up in Sydney's one of the windiest cities in the whole world, as you know, John. And, you know, you have to play links-type golf all the time. So me coming to the British Isles was a very natural fit.
That has to be the best performance of your life.
Yeah, no one was beating me that week. No. Even though I started the day 5 in front, going to the last day, I only won by 2. But it doesn't matter because I put the shutters down coming in, you know, basically to fend off Faldo, which is a horrible, you know, I want to tell you all, it's not a very nice thing to have Faldo breathing down your neck in his pomp, you know, when he was playing his best, when, you know, he was just, Faldo wasn't a dynamic golfer in the respect of he didn't obliterate golf courses. He just baffled you with science. He'd just hit it down the fairway far enough with the right club. He'd flush an iron right to left, left to right, whatever he wanted to do. And he, for a 6'4" man with hands like huge hands wrapped around a putter, he was sensational with the putter. He was an all-round player, Nick Faldo. And you don't want him chasing you because you know he's not going to go away. He's just one of those guys that just won't go away. He won't make a mistake. And to beat him was a great thing. But the way I hit the ball that week was 3 out of the 4 days I flushed one iron to 16. And you know 16, the pimple green, par 3. And it was just the best I've ever swung the club, and almost surreal on the range. The best if I could have kept that all the time, it would have been great. But I couldn't. But the way I was hitting the ball that week was I will never forget it.
At Drummond Golf, we understand your passion.
Nice roll.
And that's because every Drummond Golf store is owned and run by a local who loves the game as much as you do.
Yeah, it's come off the face really well.
Someone who knows where you play and what you need.
Oh yeah, looking good.
With Australia's biggest range and expert knowledge.
Great. Now let's try that putter with this grip.
So if you want to improve your game, see your local expert at Drummond Golf.
Tell me the moments in that last round, and there's always moments where it could have gone either way, even with a 5-shot lead. And it is Faldo we're talking about here. Where were the little turning points where you did the right thing and held them off?
Well, he got within two when I bogeyed 16 the last day. I missed the green the last day. And I pulled it left and Faldo was there. He made his par and I made a bogey. So we've got 2 holes to play, 2 in front. Yeah. And he hits it on there to about 40 feet, puts it up there nicely, and I've got one from 35 feet for birdie, and I hold it. So that was it.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the time where I'm 3 in front. Yeah. And I'll tell you a funny story, something you probably don't know. Down the last hole, we were playing it as a par 5, but it doesn't matter whether it's a par 5 or what it is, it's a par 4. It doesn't really matter because it's you've got to shoot the lowest score on it. So he hits it. I go, I put my hand on the driver and he looks at me and I just look at him and he goes, and so then I pull out the 5-iron and he shakes his head as if to say, "You wimp."
Yeah.
And I hit it out on the 17th fairway.
Right.
I hit it straight out on the 17th fairway.
With the 5-iron.
With the 5-iron.
Right.
8-iron down the fairway, wedge. Just play him totally out of it. Can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
I'm 3 in front. He can't win. That's 3 in front on the last tee at Carnoustie. Does it sound familiar?
If only Jean Vandeveld had listened.
Very clever. Very clever. And I asked him, he says, "Oh, I was confident. I said, "Well, so was I. But all I wanted to do was kiss the trophy." So it was a bit of a wimp job, Yeah. And I still get my fellow colleagues in TV. They still give me a bit about it, but yeah. Got it done.
I mean, what did Faldo say at the end?
Nothing. I know that he...
That's a surprise.
Yeah. I work with a bit with Nick now with Sky, and it's you know, he's a totally different guy to what you expect as you know, who didn't say that much, but I know that it was a fact that someone told me that in the presser after that, he says no one was going to really beat Ray Hubbard this week. He played, and he was right. I honestly played my socks off.
When did you become Radar?
When I was 14, Wayne Radar Riley. Well, Radar is MASH.
Yes.
So Radar Riley is MASH.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that's
Radar, how it's O'Reilly.
Wow. Yeah, but it's Riley, and that's where I got it. I hated it at the start, but I grew to like it. It's been good for me.
We have that in common, that we've both gained nicknames from 1970s American TV shows. Because I was never Huggy until Starsky and Hutch came out.
Really?
Yeah. No one ever called
me. He just died, didn't he? David Soul.
That's right. Anyway, when did it become clear that you were transitioning out of golf, playing golf, and into what you're doing now, and how did that come about?
That came about back in Australia, Channel 7. Jack Newton put my name forward, and they called me up one night, and they said, it was quite late, actually, it was about 10 o'clock, and I was asleep, and they called up and said, would you come and work for TV in Australia? And I went, I'd done it before, and I knew I could do it. But at that stage, I was doing something else because I've only just retired and moved back to Australia. And I went back there and I said, yeah, okay, let's give it a go. And on course, straight into on course. But the first day I'm working at the Australian Masters at Huntingdale, I'm walking up the first hole. My first day, and I haven't even broadcasted yet, we're almost 5 minutes going on air, and Wayne Smith and Lindsay Stephen, God bless Lindsay, were standing behind you. Behind me. And I went, what are you doing out here? And they went, we're out here to see how it's done. I said, I've never done it before.
Yeah.
I've done it in the box just as a guest thing.
Yeah.
So that's how much faith they had in me, the big bosses. Graham Rowland said the big, you know. Yeah. So, but after a while they walked back in after three holes and I knew I could do it. And it was just, I don't know why. It's just something that I can do. It doesn't make you better or worse than anyone else. It's just you can either do it or you can't. And it's just I've always had something to say, John. I mean, me looking at you, I'd imagine you'd be able to do it. You've got something to say. You can put it across. It's just the way it is, and I'm very fortunate in that respect.
Have a step back. It occurs to me, did you retire or did the game retire you?
That's a little – yeah. I mean, I get you there. Well, basically I can tell you that at the end of it, I had my card, and then really I could see the – I was 40, which is not old these days. We always thought 40, that was the golfing graveyard. Yeah. Goodbye. And it wasn't like that. I said, these kids are working harder than me. That means they have more desire than me, and it's time to sort of pack it up. And I did, but maybe went a little too early. Regret that a little bit. We've all got regrets. Yeah, I wasn't playing, you know, I wasn't grinding out good scores. I was just but we started very young as Australians. You know, as Australia, we had to travel from 18 years of age, 19, all around the world. And, you know, you're flying everywhere. And, you know, 21 years of it, I was pretty well burnt out. And I was like, and we didn't take much time off. These guys are complaining now of playing 24 tournaments a year. We played 33. It's a lot of events, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it used to be, I mean, Mike Clayton tells me that, you know, he would fly to Europe in March or whatever, and that would be, he wouldn't see Australia again until October, November.
No.
You know, they just stayed.
Exactly. He was on the same schedule as me, Clayton, basically. And, you know, but he retired pretty early as well. He left a little earlier than me, but rightly so. He's building golf courses and getting paid a squillion and doing a good job at that.
Well, yeah, he might argue about the squillion, but he's still does all right. Does
good at building golf courses. Yeah. I tell you what, better him than me because I tell you what, he's really doing well.
He's pretty good at what I do for a living as well.
Yeah, oh, he is. Yeah, he always was. Yeah. He always was. He'd sit on a putting green. I remember being on putting greens and he'd ask me a question. He'd be sitting there with a pad. I said, "Plates golf, you should be practicing. What are you doing?"
Yeah.
Good player himself, winner on tour. Yeah. But he was always into that side of it, you know. Things he's quite creative, Clates, and he found his niche.
Yeah, he always used to say, I think, that Peter O'Malley, no one in the history of golf missed more 10-foot birdie putts than Peter O'Malley, but I kind of wind cleats up with saying, well, nobody left more 10-foot putts short than you did.
And the famous one, if you all want to get on the on the YouTube, have a look at Clayton missing putts. I don't know what you'd look for, but he slides over and the ball hits
it's stupid golfer. If you Google stupid golfer, that's how it comes up.
And I remember someone, I was playing the group behind, someone said the first thing he said was, how many was that?
It only cost him a shot. He had the honour on the next tee. The other guy's three-putted.
We're laughing. Funniest thing you'll ever see.
Check it out. Anyway, just to get back to the commentary side of things, I'm interested in how would you define your role? What are you actually there to do? And is it your responsibility to the viewer first? And how do you see all that interaction?
Well, it's basically my job is to just, you know, sight, sounds and smells, really. I mean, that's what it is. I'm going to tell you where the wind's coming from, what is in front of the player and how he's going to go about the shot and why he's going about the shot, where's the best place to miss it. Everything, getting as close into his mind as I possibly can and relay it to the people at home, wherever they are in the world, to feel what they are feeling and feel like they haven't bought a ticket but they're watching it in their lounge.
Yeah.
That is the ultimate goal of my job, and it's fun. It's fun. When it comes off, yes, and I don't do too badly. Sure, you can't get them all right. You can't get them all right. It's easy for these guys sitting in the box. You know, they go, oh, they should have done this. After the fact, I've got to call it before it.
Yeah.
There's a huge difference. I often give them a bit of a go about that. It's all right for you sitting in there after he's hit it. I mean, you know, you got to call it before, and that's the fun thing about it, and that's why I've always wanted to be out there, and I'll never want to change. I go in the box sometimes. When we go to America and stuff like that, I'll go in there and have a little hour before, you know, the guys who sit in the box all the time, I'll go in to do it, but I still love on course. Just to go out there and fresh air and be amongst it.
Yeah.
I don't care if it's peeing it down.
Yeah.
I like it.
This always makes me think when I'm watching you, is it what – first, is it the first thing that comes into your head? Everybody says go with your first decision. Is that the same for you? And you don't get much time to talk. I mean, is that one of the frustrations of what you do, is that you don't get much time to
lay it out, if you like? You don't get a lot of time to talk, but in all honesty, there are times where you have to pre-rehearse what's happening, because I have time to stand there and watch them when the camera that you are watching isn't watching. So I'm there, and then the producer comes, right, we're going to radar's mic, radar's camera. We're down here on 11. I've already been there for 30 seconds while he's been fiddling around talking to his caddy, so that's an advantage. Doesn't happen to that all the time, but there is that, and you've got to have your wits about you constantly to listen to what they're saying, and because he's giving you a heads up, really. And you can't fly in. You can't just fly in and say anything. You know, on TV, less is more, they say. But if in doubt, nothing wrong with saying absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
Let the box do it. Because if I'm not 100% sure what this putt's going to do, I just go to my lazy switch here, I just go to the producer, to the box. I've got no idea what this putt's going to do.
Yeah.
So I don't have to speak all the time. If it's, you know, I think it's right to left and I don't know. I'm not going to, because left or right, because all the people are going to sit at home and go, there, it's blind as a bat.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's little tricks and traits about it, but you have to have your wits about you. You do walk off the golf course as tired as a player.
Well, I was going to say, I go out and walk like you, and I see what you do, and you're always way ahead.
Yeah.
I mean, you're talking about how you get to see tip off what's going to happen, but you miss a fair bit because by the necessity of the job is that you've got to be somewhere else.
Well, I don't miss it if you watch, because the only thing I miss is really knowing, but I can sort of get it, and I can ask my producer if it's a driver or a three-wood on the tee, because I can talk to him. But that is all I miss, because I'm always about 100 yards up the fairway, because if they hit it, I go and check out the lie, if it's in a divot, in the rough, and check all that out. I get my yardage and all that, and then I move towards the green.
Yeah.
That is simply to stay in front of play. And another thing is, I've got a voice that carries. It can boom.
Yes.
And basically, I have to stay away from it. So I'm watching. I'm just ahead of the game all the time. Most people, they don't do that. If you see a lot of American broadcasters, they're almost behind them.
Yeah.
I'm like, what are you doing? I mean, you've got to be in front of them, because once they finish putting, I'm off down there, yeah, 100 yards off the tee, in the same position on a par three. They hit an 8-iron, I can get up there as they're walking up. I can't walk with them, because then I'll walk on the green with them and you're in their way. Someone's going to say, get out of the way.
Yeah.
So I've got to be in front of them all the time so I can do my business and get out of their way. And that's when they're not ever worried about you.
Have you ever been overheard?
Yes. Oh, many times.
Give me an example.
Oh, Justin Thomas. I did the last time. It was Justin Thomas on the fourth hole at Riviera last year. And Bones, I tell you what, if Bones gives you a look, I tell you, you know about it. But I was just high. I was high up on the hill and got in the wrong position, kind of. Why I got in the wrong position? Because it was downwind to them, and it was just a rookie error that happens. If it was into the breeze to them, they wouldn't have heard me. But voices do carry on the wind. And but they did laugh. And when he did it, he chipped it up to a terrible chip to 15 feet. And I'm going, oh, my God, no. It's going to make a bogey and it's going to be on the back of me. But he held the putt and gave me a little wink up the hill, so it's all good. A lot of players have heard me, you know, Tigers. But it's inevitable. It's going to happen. And sometimes if you really are excited, we're getting down to the, you know, right at the end there, and it's big stuff. I've got to really walk away. I've got to really give it 150 yards because, you know, it's your job to build it as well.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, a lot of the players have, you know. Sometimes you get a caddy come up to me and Fino last week, Ian, he said before the day, he says, just, you know, a big day for us today. Just don't want to hear you. I said, okay, man. Yeah. But it's all well and good. Yeah. That's just, all right, mate. Yeah, you'll be okay. You won't hear me. Yeah. So that's a little nervy on him, too.
Yeah, yeah. Who are the talkers among the players? And when I say talkers, I mean guys that'll, you know, converse with you. And obviously, if you're like me, I'm out there. I'd never speak to a player unless he speaks to me.
Yeah, me too.
You know, that's the number one rule. But who are the guys that will interact?
Rory. The biggest player you know and that will talk is Rory, and it's not a nervy thing. He's just a nice guy. And Rory and I never talk about golf out there.
Sex, drugs?
No, it's well, last week we had a little chat about, like, how far his plane flies on a flat on
tank of petrol.
On tank of juice, yeah. And then we spoke about Man United. He was over doing a podcast with Roy Keane, and he was here for a day, and he got on the plane and flew back to Florida. And by the end of the day, he was eating his dinner in Florida, and he'd just done this podcast. And that's why he probably come to me and speak, because I'm not going to start talking about golf to him.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to go, what are you thinking of Liv? I mean, it's not that. We just talk about anything with it, you know. Look over there, look at that. Oh, look, wouldn't mind one of those burgers over there. Oh, yeah, whatever. No, it's just, but he is probably, Tiger's not bad either. Mm-hmm. He'll come over and he'll have a chat.
Surprise.
Yeah, no. Back in the day, yeah, when Tiger was, you know, he'll come over and he'll have a little chat. Stevie Wynn's when they were together. Yeah, they chat. I mean, I suppose that's the important thing is what you've just said. You don't talk about, you start talking about golf. Yeah, they're not going to come near you. But you talk about anything but. If you watch Rory McIlroy walk up the fairway with any player, if it's a young fella who's 20 and going out and play with his idol, you couldn't play with a better player than Rory McIlroy in the respect of it's ease. He won't try to intimidate you.
Yeah.
He will by his golf play, but he won't give you the cold shoulder and say nothing.
Okay, which makes me, with my evil mind, the other side of that coin, you don't have to name names, but there's some pricks out there, isn't there?
Yeah.
How do they, what's their behaviour type?
Well, you kind of go, who am I thinking about? You know what? There are some, but there aren't a lot. Probably the most unfriendly was that wouldn't say anything to me and really even look at me and acknowledge it. Phil wasn't very good at a chat.
Hmm.
you know, but not saying he's, I don't know the man well enough, even though I have known him for 100 years, I don't know the guy. You know, I've spent a lot of time commentating on him and respect his game, big style, but he's very much a golfer like a Faldo, very much in his own cocoon when he isn't smiling at the crowd. Do you know what I mean? It's like, which I never got, but nothing against Phil, you know, probably a nice person, but never would come over and say, how's your mother's chickens? He wouldn't say anything. So, yeah, but there are a lot of those, and I have nothing against that. That's well and good with me. You know, that's good on you. I mean, you don't want to speak, neither do I.
This is maybe hard to, off the top of your head, but some of the funny moments, it's got to be some that made you laugh out loud. I know it's difficult. I should have preempted
The funniest thing I think I've ever seen was we're getting back to Clayton on the 18th green at Queensland PGA when his pants split. Have you ever heard that one?
No, I haven't.
Well, I'm playing with him and Ozzie Moore, and on the 18th green his pants split. Well, right on the crack behind.
One of the funniest things I've ever ever seen. I mean, that was funny.
Yeah, but that's you're talking as a player now.
As a commentator, funny things. You know, it's you see, look, so many probably. Not that I really. No, nothing really springs to mind. That's funny. Probably because I've seen so many things that have made me laugh, but nothing. Look, I've laughed at Tiger Woods quite a lot with what he's been able to do. You know, incredible things made me laugh out loud that, you know, that's just not right. You know, that's just, you can't do that. And, but funny things, nah, I'm spoiling your party there.
No, that's all right. I mean, it's a tough question. You'll think of it about an hour and a half from now, but
maybe, yeah.
Anyway, I want to get into a little bit of the politics of golf at the moment. I mean, everybody's got an opinion on what's going on at the moment, and I'm sure you're no different. How do you see things?
I see things, our game is in a nasty place. It's in a little pickle, and I hope we can all get it together and sort something out where everyone gets a fair go. But I don't think any of us, even you as journos, know where we're at. I mean, there is enough, they're not making it clear enough, the powers that be at the moment, that we don't know which direction we're going in. And you know, there are a lot of people in this, including myself. I mean, where do I go? I mean, if I, you know, I stop, what, there's no room anymore because we're going to have one tour? Are we having one tour? Are we having a swing at the start, like over there, over here, maybe in the desert? And then are we going live? And then are we going PGA tour or in a different order? I don't know how we're all going to live together.
I mean, Rory, you know, sat down with me last week and rattled off his favourite scenario, what he would like to see. What would you like to see at the end of it? It's a different question. Nobody knows what's going to happen, but what would you like to see?
What I'd like to see, which I don't think we're going to get, I've always wanted a world tour. Yeah. I've always wanted that. I've always wanted what Norman wanted back in the day is 20 or 24, 22, whatever events, that we play around the world and whoever wants in, like an Australian Open. I'd like that. But we get to that area, Japan, like everywhere. We have like tennis or like – because tennis has a big tour and a small tour.
Yeah.
You know, at like Formula One. I've always wanted that. And there will be room for smaller events. I always wanted that. But looking at it now that we're all going to have to live together, what I would like to see is I'd like to see Swedens. I'd like to see here – in the Middle East or around this area, then I'd like to see, whether it be PGA Tour, then I'd like to see a link swing. I'd like to see that sort of thing. But I want us all to be friends because, look, it isn't our game. It's the world's game. People shouldn't just come in and bully. But, you know, if people aren't getting on with each other, you have to go in there and muscle your way in, which seems to be happening. But you know, there is a way. There surely is a way that we can all be. Yeah. We can get on.
What do you think of the way?
And these golfers are going to become very rich.
What do you think of the way Greg Norman's handled this whole thing, right from day one? I mean, do you have a relationship with him?
I had an amazing relationship with Greg back in the day, but I don't see. He was incredibly kind to me and flew me around with him on his plane. I went to his house. But I haven't seen Greg in a long time. Greg is a seriously busy man, and I don't want to get in there and, you know, he's got wine, he's building houses and all. So he doesn't need me sort of calling him up. And, no. You know, but in my he's been an incredible friend. And, look, I can see where he's coming from. Back in the day, he got told that this world tour was going to happen, and in the locker room the last minute, from what I hear, I wasn't in that room, he got let down. And that's what we heard. That's what you've heard?
Yeah. We've all heard. That's what's caused the bitterness.
Yeah. That's what's caused the bitterness. And he wants to see, I'm just seeing what I read now, and I spoke to him actually, might have been last year, I saw him here at the airport here in Dubai, and we just had 10 minutes chat. We were just getting on a plane, I was getting on a plane. And he says, you know, all he wants to do is he wants to see the best players make a lot of money. And because he was war number one for so very long. And I think a lot of people were Nicky Price as well and these other players. A lot of people were sitting on the coattails of those great players. Yeah. And I understand that, you know. They are making these lesser likes a whole heap of money. And he didn't like that. And now all I can see is that's what Greg's. It'd be interesting to right now, because I know he's given a few interviews and I've watched them. It'd be interesting to if someone could get him now and sit him down and we could all sit and hear what he's got to say now, where we're at, so we get more clarity about where we are all at. I mean, I know Greg, he's an Australian. He's a traditionalist of the game. He loves the game. He's an open champion. He's world number one. He loves the game. He's not going to try to go in there and spoil the game. He's going to make it better for the professional golfers, and he wants to make it. Let's just look what happened in Adelaide at that live event. That was mighty impressive. That was
part of that.
A few of them were.
I agree with you, but I mean, part of it is that Australia's been starved of that level player.
100%. Yeah. 100%. But what they did down there in Adelaide, it's going to take them a while, I think, to come to places. There's going to be room for one round here. It's very easy to sit here and have a whinge and a whine about everything. But we don't know, Huggy. We don't know.
Do you think he's spoiled his legacy, though? Do you think his image is different now?
I don't know what it's like in Australia or it's like in Europe, but I know in Australia he hasn't, because I've just been down there for three and a half years. He's still a hero down there. Yeah. And it's like...
Well, your generation, or maybe slightly younger, I mean, they grew up idolising him, didn't they?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. We all did. I mean, what he did, like, you know... We made Shark owes us money because we made him look good. He had to beat up on someone, and we were rich.
Yeah.
And it's like, and now he's into this what he's doing, and it's like, look, in 10 years' time, John, we might look at this, and live might be the best thing in the world.
I hope you're
right. We don't know.
I hope this is an opportunity to finally get it right.
Yes,
but if they don't get it right this time, it's not going to happen.
That's exactly right. You are spot on. So get it right. Bring something good, and then we've got the majors, then we've got all these players, and then we've got the Dubai Desert Classic, then we've got the Abu Dhabi Championship, and then we've got these unbelievable events that we're all going to enjoy.
It might just be as simple as, you know what, let's just pick the best bits from everywhere.
That's right. Well, that's exactly.
You know.
Exactly. That's it. The Scottish Open, the Irish Open.
Yeah.
It's not as if we're struggling for great events.
No.
And great players.
And take them to better courses than... I mean, I do get a bit, the PGA Tour, there are exceptions, obviously, but I mean, I do think.
Some of them.
I've seen this course before. What was last week?
Yeah, I know. Some of them, I'm totally.
And they're all set up the same way. You know,
the fairways are
the same way.
We said that before. It's one dimensional.
What's that about?
You know, when you go to a tour event, sometimes, you know, it's like going to McDonald's and buying a Big Mac. You're going to get a Big Mac. Doesn't matter where you are. It's always the same. Fluffy around the greens, greener running 11 and a half. I mean, you can show up on Wednesday night and play the soft fairways.
Yeah.
You know?
I'm tired of all that.
Yeah.
Let's hope they get it right. That's maybe a great place to stop. Radar, thank you for your
John,
time.
John, absolute pleasure. Anytime,
it's been a
mate.
Pleasure. And it's nice to see you. He is, just for the listeners' benefit, you are wearing your hat, of course.
I'm wearing the hat, yeah. I've got to go out and do some hole pieces right now. But this is Australia, but I'm sure you'll listen anywhere around the world. It's been a blast. Huggy's good broadcaster, but don't tell him.
Anyway, Radar, thanks for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, buddy.
Cheers, mate.
a great storyteller and doesn't pull any punches, Wayne Riley. A big thanks to both him and John Huggan for taking the time to sit down for that chat. Well, we'll stick with the player-turned-TV commentator theme for our next, when John Huggan catches up with another Sky Sports voice, Nick Doherty.
From a player's standpoint, the reason that I always love the US Open is that part of me really adored the brutality and lack of fairness to it, because let's be honest, golf is a particularly unfair game.
That's next time on The Thing About Golf.